Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. It's the international break. Alex and I were chatting before. This is particularly brutal. The good news is it's the last one until March. But as always, we are determined to cure your international break blues and try to deliver a great episode. So I recorded two awesome interviews. A lot going on with Roma and Mourinho. So I brought in our friend Steve Chavilla from Chiesa di Totti to take stock of that. And then since it is the international break and there are a lot of good movies out right now, I was excited to have my dear friend Andrew Barker on. We talked a little bit about Inter. I always like getting his philosophical perspective on Inter. And we chatted quite a bit about movies. So I think that'll be a nice way for everyone to go into the weekend. Maybe you'll be inspired to check something out to get through this dreadful international break. But before we get to all that, I'm joined by our dear friend, producer, co-host of this podcast, Alex Goldberg, does a fantastic job also on the byline covering Chelsea. But today we're going to focus more on Serie A. So, Alex, I figure this is a good time to take stock. We're about a third of the season in. So I picked six storylines, and I want you to tell me how much of these storylines are you buying, and then I'll give my thoughts on these. So let's start with Milan, and it was in New York, and we'll get into a little bit later on the awesome event that Milan, a New York fan club, hosted. So I was watching the derby, and I have to say my takeaway from that game is I'm still convinced Inter is the best team in Serie A right now. And a lot of Milan fans get mad and they point to me, well, 7-point gap. I get all that. I just think Inter, I still believe, are the team with the least flaws. They've won it before. So they are still my pick. But I have to say, watching that derby, I am more and more convinced that Milan really could be a team of destiny. I mean, you have the backup keeper that we all agreed was a liability, making a great save on a penalty by Lautaro, a good penalty, not a bad penalty taken. And you're like, I'm starting to think that really this is Milan year. So do you buy in the storyline? Inter may be the better team, but Milan are a team of destiny, and the 7-point gap is going to be tough for Inter to make up.
Well, yeah, David, I am buying it because I think the 7-point gap allows me to activate the fact that Milan might be the team of destiny, if you know what I mean. So I kind of subscribe to that idea anyway, that there's this little magic with Milan this season. But if they were tied with Inter on points, I might say, well, that still might not be enough, that magic that we're referencing, because I do agree that Inter, I think, overall are probably the better team. Or maybe I should rephrase it, David, at least for me personally, perhaps the team I trust more. I think I trust Inter a little bit more. But the 7-point gap is small or big, depending on how you look at it. It's small if you want to just look at how much of the season is still left. But still, it's big because that's more than two wins. You know, that's two wins and a draw. Like, that's still big enough as well. So if Milan have a good squad, which they do, it's not great, but they have a good one. And they have good balance. You know, they have the senior heads, the players in their prime, and the younger players as well. So if they have a good squad that I rate and they have the 7-point gap and they clearly have some type of a magic, I'm not saying it's a Leicester City magic from a handful of years ago, but it feels like there is something cooking there. I totally agree with you. There is an aura. And by the way, I've been saying for a while that ever since Zlatan arrived, whether he's on the pitch or not, there's this little extra magic. Yeah, I think I can subscribe to that, David, where Inter are probably the quote-unquote better team. As I said, though, probably the team I trust more. But I think between the 7-point difference of the Milans, I should say, and the fact that AC has that little magic, yeah, I subscribe to that theory, David.
Yeah, this is a tough one for me. There's other storylines, which we'll get to, that I feel are much more of a lock. Because here's the thing. I was thinking this morning, I always try to say, what's the opposite argument? And I think for Milan, what I was thinking this morning is I keep saying for Juve, the big problem is there's no player that I trust to score at least 12 goals for sure this season. And I was starting to think, huh, do I feel the same way about Milan? And I kind of do, like Giroud maybe gets there. Ibra healthy. So, but I do think they have enough to overcome that. It's just because their midfield so much better than Juve. So in that sense, I'm like, Juve has other problems to then have that on top of it. Milan is just very strong in all other areas. So I do buy this idea that this really could be Milan's year. The counter would be what happens with the Africa Cup. But Kessie's absence doesn't feel like it's going to be that big of a deal. The Bennacer one could be. So I am buying this one, but lukewarm. There are others that I buy more. So speaking of Africa Cup, next one that comes up with Napoli. They're off to a great start. They're tied with Milan, best defense in the league, which we know in Serie A usually goes really a long way. But we know in the past, Napoli have not had great mental fortitude. They've had some self-inflicted wounds, and they are losing, I would say, arguably three of their five best players right now to Africa Cup, if it happens, Koulibaly, Anguissa, Osimhen. They are somewhat deep, but not great. So the storyline is, yeah, Napoli are off to a great start, but because of their previous years keeping it together and losing these three players for Africa Cup, that's going to be too much to overcome for them and hold on to win the Scudetto. Do you agree with this storyline?
It's a tough one because that's a pretty big hit for Napoli to lose Osimhen, Anguissa, and Koulibaly, who, as you said, have been three of their best players. I think Osimhen and Anguissa have started 10 games. Koulibaly has started 11 within the league. So, I mean, they're staples within their preferred 11. There's no doubt about that. And they're good performers. I mean, Osimhen, we shower him with praise, rightfully so. Anguissa, I'm like a secret fan of. He was at Fulham, I want to say, the other year. And he actually was kind of fun to watch. Yeah, I was obviously tuning into Fulham games to watch Loftus-Cheek, who is on loan there, and it was really just kind of a rough year for Ruben. It was more about finding his feet again. And I found myself internally hating on Anguissa, not for any reason other than I just wanted it to be Ruben, who was dribbling so powerfully throughout the midfield. But Anguissa is a player that catches your eye, and yeah, he's definitely caught the eye of many Serie A and Napoli fans this season. So he's been really impressive. And then, I mean, I don't really need to speak about the importance of Koulibaly, who might not be the elite guy he was a few years ago, but he's having a good season. He really is. So it's a tricky one because I just never really know how much the African Cup of Nations will take away from the club teams game-wise. I know it is always going to be a range of games, but it could be just enough where it does hurt Napoli and it is hard to overcome it. And the fact that they are kind of, well, not kind of, they're factually tied with Milan right now on points. They have a +5 better goal differential. You know, it might be too much for them to overcome, David. You know, I obviously, I'd love to know how that little time goes without those players, because I think if they can survive that time, then that probably speaks volumes on how likely they are to actually win the league. But no, I think that might be too big of a hit. Like, if they had a 7-point cushion right now, then I might say, you know what, I think they can overcome it. But because I do think that Inter still has a chance, obviously, to win the title, Milan certainly does. I mean, Atalanta would really have to go crazy. But yeah, I don't know, David. Those players are really important. I'm going to say that actually that might be too much for them to overcome.
Yeah. So as always, let's look at the opposite argument. How does Napoli overcome this? And I'm going on the assumption, for this argument's sake, Africa Cup happens, they miss somewhat significant amount of games. And we know sometimes when the players come back, they're not quite the same. Yeah. So what would Napoli need to overcome this? They need, for Koulibaly, Romani's been playing well. They need Manolas to get back on track. That's somewhat doable. Anguissa, you need Lobotka, who's been a bust for them. Demme, who's been pretty good, to really step up. And you need Fabian Ruiz to keep it up without Anguissa, who's been really, really helpful for him. And then Osimhen, you need either Mertens or Petagna to come through. So let's say two out of those three happen. Is it enough? Maybe. Keep in mind, they're not 7 points behind Milan, so behind Milan like Inter is. So I don't know, but let's put it this way. I buy this storyline more than the first one. Yeah. Let's go to the next
one. I want to say, think about that. Osimhen and Guisa Koulibaly is a spine. It's a spine. Midfield, center back. I mean, that hurts to lose, man. That's a huge identity when you lose your spine of performers, like players that are actually performing.
Yeah, I agree. This one, for sure. Next one, this is probably my lock, that Immobile is a lock to lead the league in scoring despite suffering an injury. He's supposed to come back early December, so he'll miss probably two games or so. So right now he leads with 10. Behind him, we have Giovanni Simeone, who's been an unbelievable role, with 9. Vlahovic, 8. And then we have Zeko, Zapata, João Pedro with 7. The others that are left, I guess we have Lautaro and Osimhen with 5. I mean, then you would really need someone to come through. So I'm going to tell you right now, this is the one that I feel the best of. I had doubts a little bit on Immobile because Sarri's system somewhat similar to Italy's system, where Immobile is not as good, but he has 10. He's shown to take penalties. He's good at it. Lazio's been playing better. So this one for me is an absolute lock. Do you agree?
Yeah, I don't want to dismiss the question because it still should be asked, but I totally agree. I'm pretty consistent when we do our over-unders, whenever we do them, whether it's before the season or halfway through. I'm pretty consistent, I think, with always taking the over on Ciro, because I always think he's going to be a 20-goal-a-season scorer. And it sounds like he's not going to miss that many games. Like you say, he's in the lead only by 1, but I don't see, no offense to Giovanni Simeone, I don't see him actually becoming like a 20-goal-this-season league scorer. The only really other guys I even give a chance to catch up and surpass Ciro are probably Vlahovic and Zapata.
I agree.
I wouldn't say Dzeko, because I think even though Dzeko will have a good season, you know, I just think at this point he's not going to get high teens or 20. And then Osimhen on talent, like, I know he only has 5 right now. Fine, maybe he could go on a roll and flirt with it. But like we just said, he's going to be missing some games automatically because of AFCON. So yeah, I only give Vlahovic and Zapata a chance. But Ciro, even if they were all even, would still probably be my pick. So yeah, I'm definitely locking that one in as well.
Yeah, I agree with you, Vlahovic and Zapata being the more likely. It probably takes slightly Zapata because he's on a better team. But yeah, this is the one that I feel the best of. Okay, so let's talk about Atalanta. So the storyline, they may not win the Scudetto, but they will definitely finish ahead of Roma and Lazio, who of course have much bigger payrolls. Atalanta right now 22 points, Lazio 21, and Roma 19. And don't worry, Alex, we have a storyline on Mourinho coming. But let's start with this one. Do you think the storyline, well, they may not win the Scudetto, but they will at least finish ahead of both clubs, Roman clubs?
I do. Hey, I really like Atalanta. I know I'm not at all unique in saying that, but they're just a team you want to root for, at least as a neutral. But of course, it's not just based on sentiment and emotion. They're a dangerous team, and they're a team like a three-point shooter in the NBA. Don't let them get on a run. Don't let them get hot. And I just think that they have, especially in short spurts, David, compared to a Lazio and a Roma, they have way more firepower. Like, I think if they went on a little run compared to Lazio or Roma going on a little run, I actually think it would just be more impactful. It'd be more points. It would be defined differently. It'd be more dangerous to the rest of the league. Like, put it this way, I'm going to kind of use your logic in terms of how you're flipping the question around to figure out what your accurate answer is. But I'll just say this, like, to tweak it a bit. If you told me, ooh, Alex, Atalanta went on a run, or you told me, ooh, Alex, Lazio went on a run, and you told me, oh, Alex, Roma went on a run, just based on that simple sentence, I don't even know what that means, right? You're not giving me any more details. But then you ask me, all right, which run do you think was more impactful, more points gained, or just more ground covered on opponents? I would say Atalanta. I'd be like, well, man, Atalanta going on a run is scary. And, you know, they're in better position now anyway. And listen, I don't want to now make this all about Lazio and Roma, but does Alex Goldberg really think that a Sarri-led team or a Mourinho-led team can be smooth sailing? Not really anymore. No. And I think there's going to be more mess than glory, to be honest. It doesn't mean I think these teams are going to just completely fall down the table. But I think because Serie A is so competitive this season, it's not top-heavy competitive like if you had three different Juves of years past, but it's competitive for the title and top four. I don't think that really works all that well for Lazio or Roma compared to an Atalanta. Because Atalanta, I feel like they're still fearless. I know expectations have risen, David, over the years. I get that. But I still feel like there's a part of Atalanta that are fearless. And I feel like with Lazio and Roma, even though they're clearly trying to get back to maybe where they used to be, especially Roma, I still feel like there's more pressure on them. I do. So, yeah, I'm saying Atalanta finishes ahead of both of those teams, David.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I do like Atalanta. One thing that sticks out to me is Atalanta, and we always look at their defense as them giving up goals as kind of their Achilles heel. They've given up four less than Lazio, and they're tied with Roma. They have scored less goals than Lazio and just one more than Roma. Now, I definitely think that gap on Roma is going to grow with amount of goals scored. Lazio gives me a little pause because Lazio has done well against the good teams, not so much against the small teams. Can that improve? Maybe. But Roma, I absolutely think Atalanta are finishing ahead. But yeah, I'm going to buy this one too, but I will give Lazio a slight chance. Okay, the one you've been waiting for and I've been waiting for. Mourinho doesn't even make it to his return to San Siro to face Inter on April 24th. Of next year. The Venezia game was fantastic. If you are really bored this international break and you want to watch a game, that one had everything to keep you excited. After the match, Mourinho, as usual, threw his bench under the bus. I pointed out what Venezia's bench was. I think even the biggest Serie A junkie would have had a very hard time naming four or five players on Venezia's bench. So it was classic Mourinho. So do you think it's getting so bad that he won't even finish the season and won't even make it to this date against Inter, which is his return to San Siro with another Serie A team? Do you think that will happen?
Oh, man. You're really putting me in a position where I should probably stay true to my ongoing dialogue on Mourinho and say he won't make it to that date. I don't know. On the other hand, I think Mourinho is so ego-driven that he's going to want to be a part of that. So maybe he just stays on his P's and Q's just enough to still be manager of Roma by then. But I don't know. He's just so not what he used to be. I'm not going to go on a huge Mourinho tangent. I'm sure you saw people tried to cook me when I posted Roma's recent results after they lost to Venezia. And no offense to Venezia, by the way. I mean, Ethan Ampadu, Chelsea Loney with an assist in that game. But anyway, just the results for Roma have been shambolic lately. They're slipping up to teams like in the Europa League conference that I've never heard of. And I had all these people, David, I promise this is not going to go way off the rails, but I had all these people say, well, look at the squad of players Mourinho took over. Take that and shove it up your behind. Honest to God, he chose these players. And are you telling me that these Roma players, even the B squad, aren't good enough to get better results, to not lose 6-1 to Bodo Glimt, or however the heck you pronounce their name? So a B squad for Roma should be losing 6-1? Mourinho should be losing 6-1 with those players and then drawing in the return leg? Get out of town. Get out of town. Honestly, if Mourinho could step out of his body and judge himself, he would say, oh my God, what a shambolic performance by the manager. He holds the highest standard for himself. So, sorry. Enough with the excuses. Enough with the excuses. The squad for Roma could get a bit better. It's not going to get that much better. He chose this team. So, stop it. He's not what he used to be. He's a dinosaur. He doesn't adapt to the modern game. He doesn't. With that said, David, his ego is going to make him manager on April 24th, 2022. He's not going anywhere just yet. Maybe soon after he'll be gone.
Yeah, I agree with that. Because I don't think Roma's going to fire him, even as bad as it gets, because they really wanted to make a splash with him. So he would have to leave, in my opinion. I don't think he quite does that. You could look at all his statements now and even him throwing his bench under the table as a way for him to put pressure on Roma to spend in January. You know, a couple of additions, get Roma all of a sudden look better, possibly. I would be concerned with the fact, I mean, we've been talking a lot about Tammy's bad luck, but I'd be very concerned with how poor Mkhitaryan has been this season. And last year, around this time, we were talking how Mkhitaryan maybe should be in the mix for Serie A MVP. So look at what a big drop off that was. But yeah, I tend to agree with you. I do think he makes it. But what I will say is, to me, it's more likely that he doesn't make it to this game than it is that he finishes his 3-year contract. Without a doubt. Between the two, if you tell me what's more likely, like he leaves before this game or that he finishes the contract, no doubt about it, I'm going with that. But hey, we need Mourinho in the league because there's just a bounce in Alex step when we talk about it, and I enjoy it. Dude, look, I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I've been really up and down with Roma. I have been sucked into the whole thing, and they are that. I mean, that game against Venezia was fantastic, so they are entertaining with him. So we need him to stay in the league. Please, Jose, just give us this whole season, and then we'll see what happens. Okay, let's close on Juve. So Juve right now are in 8th place, 18 points. They squeeze through with Cuadrado magic, and my new comp is Cuadrado is a little bit like Leon on curb. He comes in, just saves the day. You never expect it, and he just comes through. So Cuadrado saves Juve once again. Had they not won that game before the break, I think this would be an absolute lock. But the storyline is Juve don't finish in the top 4. So they have 18 points now. Fiorentina has 18 points. Roma has 19. Lazio, 21. Atalanta, 22. So Juve needs to leapfrog these 4 teams to get there. Do you think Juve don't finish in the top 4 is a lock as a storyline?
Close, because honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if the current top 4 is the top 4 at season's end, perhaps in a different order. But let me put it this way, to once again kind of do what you've been doing. I can make a stronger argument for Napoli, AC Milan, Inter Milan, and Atalanta finishing in the top 4 than I can for Juve. Definitely. The only strong argument I can make for Juve finishing the top 4 is really just based on history. And maybe based on the fact that they still have really good players in some areas. It's not what they used to be, but they still have, obviously, if we're talking about talent, they're still way up there. I mean, maybe people would think they have the most talent in Serie A. It's, once again, not at all what they used to be. But between Allegri, who's experienced, of course, and a good handful of Juve players definitely still having big names and big resumes, that's my strongest argument as to why they'll finish in the top 4. But David, I hate that argument. That's an argument that really isn't looking at anything in the now. It's not looking at any details. It's not looking at any context. It's just saying, well, those are the bigger names. It's Juve. They'll finish in the top 4. That's a weak argument. So I don't think it's a lock that they'll finish outside the top 4. But I think it's close because, once again, I feel way more confident in Napoli, Milan, Inter, and Atalanta finishing in the top 4 than Juve.
Yeah, I liked what you said, that this could very easily be the top 4 at the end of the season, maybe not in this order, so that makes sense. So look, let's take Fiorentina, Roma, Lazio out of the equation completely. Are Juve going to catch up 4 points to Atalanta? Atalanta, we know, are a team that peaks later in the season. Atalanta are deep. They've had a lot of injuries, Atalanta, and they're still right there. Juve, you look at their numbers, 16 goals scored. I don't think they're going to have like a great attack this season. Now, with Allegri, they've won a lot of games 1-0, but they've still already conceded 15 goals, which is the same amount as Roma, which we're talking as being a huge defensive liability We talked how Inter's defense hasn't been as good as in the past, although it is. And they've given up two less goals than Juve. So I don't know. With Milan, I think they can overcome not having a player that guarantees you 12, 13 goals in Serie A because they're so strong in the other areas. But Juve, having that on top of not having a reliable midfield, though McKinney, I have to say, has been playing better. And Locatelli has been really good, as we expected. So I don't know if I want to be bold and say lock, but I'm with you. It's certainly more likely that they won't than not. If I had to put a percentage, it would probably be something like 67% they don't make the top four. So I'm kind of going to give them a 33% chance. Is it possible they just figure it out? Is it possible in January maybe they make one move that really helps them? Perhaps. But a lot needs to go Juve's way for them to turn things around. And I'm with you. When I look at this top four, it makes sense that maybe the order changes, but that's what it is. So great stuff, Alex. This was a very good way to take stock of the season so far. But look, it's the international break. There's a lot of transfer rumors. We're going to try to stick to the reliable ones. I have to say, yesterday, I really enjoyed reading some of them on Twitter. On the same day, I read that Pogba will stay at Man United, but only if he gets paid more than Ronaldo, which I'm assuming means he wants to be the highest paid player in the Premier League, unless Ronaldo ended up taking a big pay cut to go to Man United. So on one hand, there was that. And then I read another story that said Pogba is so desperate to go back to Juve, he's willing to take a pay cut. So I always say, look where these stories come from, who the target audience is. You could probably figure out that those reports have different target audience. So take them all with a grain of salt. So we're going to try to stick with some more reliable news and go over some topics that have been discussed by Fabrizio and Gianluca. So which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right. Well, let's start with, honestly, a team that I am consistently seeing rumored for a Serie A target, and we'll focus on Juve target here. What do you make of Arsenal's interest in Kulusevski?
You guys know he is one of my favorite players. I absolutely adored him at Parma. It's been disappointing at Juve. And look, you can absolutely point to the fact he's been played in a lot of different roles, really hasn't had a manager that developed him. Chiesa kind of stole his thunder. I think when Juve originally bought Kulusevski, they were kind of expecting to get what they got from Chiesa. Then they were able to sign Chiesa later on pretty good terms, and they did. So look, you could point to a lot of things going wrong for Kulusevski at Juve, but I always say the player does share some responsibility as well. He's just nowhere near been as dominating as he was at Parma. So maybe he needs a change of scenery. The buts, Juve spent a decent amount to get him, 40 million. It wasn't a loan with option to buy. It was real cash money that they did. So they won't give him up cheaply. He does have a lot of upside. I think he's only 22 right now. Did show great things even with Sweden at times. So I would buy that Kulusevski can turn it around on another team, with the understanding that he plays in a system somewhat like Parma, which was, you know, counterattack, where he was playing on the wing. So it would have to be something similar to that. As far as Arsenal's interest in him, what's interesting is their main target was Vlahovic. It seemed they did everything they could, contacted Fiorentina, tried to make an offer to Vlahovic, who has a year and a half left on his contract. Vlahovic agent's not even returning their call, so they're looking at another player. Now, Kulusevski and Vlahovic are very different players, so that gives me a little pause, but you look at Arsenal, they want a young team. They want to develop it. Makes sense that they would target him. And again, if I was running a team, I would. This is Kulusevski would be exactly the type of player I would try to target. Someone who obviously has talent, has done it, and has just been in a crappy situation. And you're like, we're going to give this guy a lifeline. The other thing is we've also heard rumors that Kulusevski could go back to Atalanta, the team where he came through their youth system, and with Muriel going to Juve. And I actually think that swap, there's a lot to be said about that swap. I think it makes a lot of sense for all involved. We know Gasperini wants another offensive toy. Miranchuk, there's talk that he's not happy. He's not getting enough time there. So I don't know. Is that maybe more likely than Kulusevski going to Arsenal? Maybe. But I think Arsenal are on the right track pursuing him. I'm not sure if that's exactly the place for him. But I also, if you're saying, well, we can't get Vlahovic, we're going to get Kulusevski, well, then you're getting two very different players too.
Yeah, as long as they know that. As long as they know that. But I don't need them getting either one of those players. I mean, Arsenal are not a team that I fear now, but they're playing better as of late, and they do have some good young players, so I definitely don't need them getting one of those guys. All right. Do you think Inter should re-sign Perisic, David?
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about the players on Bosman. We'll get to another one in a second. At Inter, obviously, Brozovic is a much bigger priority, both because of age and how important he is in their system. We've talked a lot about it. If Brozo leaves, that's a pretty big change for the way Inter plays. But I think Perisic has been really good. I kind of compare it a little bit how in the NBA, players who have expiring contracts, sometimes they have a great season to get that next deal. But Perisic was good to last season. He's continued it. Been good in this international break. He's having a great season. I do think within reason, Inter should keep Perisic. I think DiMarco's good, but I'm not sure he's ready to be a full-time starter. If you can offer a 1-2 year deal to Perisic, I would do it. I still think he's a big game player. He's not the most consistent, but he does well. And look, there's plenty of teams in Serie A that I think could use Perisic. So I think he has a market, but I think Inter should resign. I'm not a very long deal, but obviously if the choice is Perisic and Brozovic, that's an easy choice. You go Brozo every time.
Hmm. All right, David, last one here in this segment. Any chance Lorenzo Insigne moves to the MLS and joins Toronto, just like our good friend Sebastian Giovinco?
Yeah, and look, I've heard buzz in Toronto that Insigne isn't the only Serie A player they are making offers to, Belotti being another one, another guy on the Bosman. Both Belotti and Insigne have expiring deal. So interesting. So Di Marzio's report, and I read it again this morning just to be sure, is that Napoli have made Insigne an offer with a lower base salary. So he's taking a slight pay cut. Right away, my mind went to that. I thought Napoli gave Mertens way too much money. That was the first contract, the first big contract during COVID. And if I was Insigne and I looked at that, I'd be like, you know what? I have more to give than at this time right now than when Mertens resigned that contract. So look, I'm usually not too critical about the way Napoli run things, but I think that wasn't a great precedent. I do think all things being equal or close to equal, Insigne would much rather stay at Napoli. You know, there's the rare player that can be from his hometown, play his whole career. He has a family. I still think he's going to resign there, and these reports are to put pressure on him. Now, I don't doubt that Toronto are making these offers. They are interested. They have a huge Italian community there. The Giovinco thing was a huge home run. So I think there's a chance. Let's put it this way. I think there's a better chance Insigne would do the MLS Toronto experience than it is that he goes to another big league in Europe. I'll say that. I wouldn't exclude him going to Inter, although tactically maybe not the biggest fit for him there. But if I had to rank the order of what I think happens with Insigne, number one would be staying at Napoli. That's still, I think, the most likely. Number two, I would say going to Inter. I don't know if there's any other Serie A team he would really go to. Maybe Milan, but I don't know if he's the type of player they would because of age and salary. And then I would put Toronto. I wouldn't put, you know, going to a Premier League team or PSG or that. I don't see him doing, would be my guess. Maybe I'm way off, but that I think there's a chance he goes to MLS. I wouldn't say it's a great one. Before we get to Roma, I just want to take a moment to thank my friend Franco from the New York City Milan fan club. We had him on last week. Went to the event at Jay-Z's bar club 40 for 40, the Milan watch party. It was a fantastic event. I want to give huge kudos to Milan, because we often talk on the podcast how frustrating it is for Serie A fans that are outside of Italy. And hey, even in Italy with the zone and all the issues. So I think it's really up to the clubs to kind of make up for it. And, you know, we've talked a lot too on the podcast what the Premier League did to become so popular here in the U.S. And a lot of it were these grassroots events, like organizing events, getting fans together. Was awesome. There were a lot of fans from the East Coast, Boston, Philly. It was great to see my friend Dave and Angie from Philly. Great to see my friend Mark Strupa from Boston. Really fantastic stuff. But there was also people from the West Coast. Just a superb event. So kudos to Milan for doing it. Serie A desperately needs these events. The place was packed. The atmosphere was awesome. I can't help but think that anyone who attended that event or maybe even saw some videos wouldn't be more interested in it. So great job, Franco. I always know how much hard work goes into organizing all this stuff. I thought it was a huge home run, and kudos to Milan. So let's shift gears. We're going to talk a little bit more about Roma and Mourinho with our good friend Steve Sciavillo from Chiesa di Totte. Okay, guys, I'm very excited to be joined by our next guest. He's become a great friend of the show, Steve Sciavillo from the outstanding Chiesa di Totti podcast and website that is obviously a Roma-focused place. And there's definitely a lot going on with Roma. So I'm very excited to catch up with Steve. So my good friend, bentornato to Calcioland. Always a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me back on, David. Excited to chat culture with you, even if things in our neck of the woods aren't going so hot right now.
Yeah, but they're always intriguing, at least with Mourinho. At least there's always a lot going on. And the thing with him is sometimes you have to really be careful if you have to take him at face value, if there's a strategy with what he's saying. So I want to start with this. After the game against Venezia, which was a very exciting game, maybe not so much for you, more for neutrals, Mourinho, you know, complained about his bench and then also said that the team is no better than last season because they had a reactionary transfer window. So do you agree with that assessment? Do you think it is fair to say that this Roma squad is no better than the one that Fonseca had last season?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because we recorded our podcast yesterday, which was Tuesday, by the time this gets published, probably on Friday. But, you know, and we beg the question, is like Mourinho full of tired excuses right now, or are they actually words of wisdom? Like, you know, is there some kind of like sage knowledge he has because he's this experienced manager and when he evaluates this roster? But I mean, the Mercato was reactionary in the sense that Tammy was brought in when Jekyll left, but let's be honest, at this point in their careers, I'd much rather have Tammy Abraham if we're building a project, as they keep calling it in Rome. You know, Vigna was a reactionary move because Spinazzola went down. But, you know, I think he's filled in pretty well. And then Patricio was a player Mourinho acknowledged that he wanted, and they got him. And he's definitely an upgrade to me over Paulo Lopez at this point. You know, he's been pretty solid in goal. So it's hard for me to say that last year's team was better. I mean, at worst, you could probably say they're maybe on par in terms of, you know, talent levels. But then you also have to think, you know, Nicolò Zaniolo returned this year. Has he been the Nicolò Zaniolo pre-second ACL? Not quite yet, but he's shown some flashes, especially on the ball, but hasn't scored yet. So I think it's hard to say that last year's team was better. You know, it's funny, he brought up the depth, and he brings up the depth a lot in his press conferences recently. I read them all the time, and you'll see, you know, after Juve, oh, you know, if Juve has a guy out, they could bring in a guy like DeCilio to start at right back. And look, he had an assist. And, you know, if we're playing Milan and Kier's out, they could bring in Romagnoli. And he throws like thousands of examples like that at you. But at the same time, you know, you came in knowing this was your squad. You know that the fat had to be trimmed a bit. And then this week he goes, well, you see, this is why like guys like Juan Jesus and Bruno Pérez could have been useful for us in matches like this. And he brought up the fullback situation with, literally every left back was hurt this week, even our third string left back, Calafiori, was out besides Spinazzola and Vigna. So, like, I don't know. I think it's hard to say that last year's squad was better because last year's squad had holes, and I think Tammy's a good addition. I think Patricio's a good addition. Even Shamordov is a pretty good addition. You know, if players from that squad were so good to you, why didn't you just keep them around instead of having Pinto send them away? So I think that's maybe him just trying to buy himself and the team some more time and kind of take the pressure off his players a bit, because they've had a tough run of results, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we can distinguish between reactionary, as you said, they were Dzeko left, but I think there was a lot of appetite from a lot of Roma fans to move on from him anyway, and the Spinazzola injury, but that doesn't also mean that the team is worse there. So I wanted to start with that, but the other lead question is this: on a scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are you with the state of Roma and how this season could turn?
I'm going to go on the lower end here and say about a 4, just because, you know, he was brought in on a 3-year contract. The Friedkins had in mind a project. He wasn't like the Tottenham situation where he was brought in to immediately win a trophy or many of the other clubs he's been with. You know, I expect rough patches with him. You know, we know his reputation. I don't think he'll burn out as fast in Rome as he did in Tottenham or United and some of these places, because I think the Friedkins will be a bit more patient with him than Levy and some of the other owners were, just because of the situation he's inherited. I think, you know, you do have to build the roster and his image a bit. Have there been refereeing calls going against Roma lately? Yes. Does he have to point it out every press conference? No, but again, I think this is part of him just giving his team like that us against the world mentality in some ways, maybe to try to build up their mental fortitude. You know, so I'm not super concerned yet if this streak continues through November when the schedule eases up a bit, because October was a tough stretch with, you know, 3 big teams and consecutive weekends. Then I'd be more concerned if, you know, teams like Genoa and some of the other clubs coming up do what Venezia did to us.
Okay, so you sound pretty fairly optimistic. And if you had to say, it's more likely that things, is it fair to say that you think it's more likely things will improve rather than get progressively worse, which we know at Roma is something that can happen? It sounds like you think it's more likely things will get a little bit better. Is that fair?
I do. I think, you know, we were talking about this on our podcast this weekend. One of the other guys said it first, and I agreed with him that the real Roma, I posed the question, you know, the first half of what we've seen so far this season, pre-October international break when Roma was kind of cruising, is that the real Roma? Is the one we've seen this past month of October? And he said, you know, it's kind of in the middle, because, you know, the schedule is tough in October and there's been injuries and things like that. And I tend to agree with him that we should see maybe not as good as Roma was when they were like flying high the first month of the season or so, but I think they'll improve on where they were in October. You know, playing Juve, Napoli, and Milan on consecutive weekends is tough. And Juve and Napoli, they were in those matches the whole time. Could have won the Juve match. I think should have won the Juve match if it wasn't for Juve scoring that early goal and then just playing Allegri's low block, as we've seen them do so many times. And the Napoli match, they played with, you know, a first-place team head-to-head. They went toe-to-toe with them. So I think they have what it takes to certainly show improvement. I personally still expect them to be in the top 4 fight. To the end, I don't know if they'll finish top 4, but I definitely think they should be in the mix longer than they were last season under Fonseca.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Tammy, because I'm a fan. I was a fan of his when he was at Chelsea. I like Dzeko, and I think a lot of Roma fans maybe underestimated how much Dzeko did. But I think Tammy's been very good. He's been pretty unlucky, in my opinion. I think if you had to make the case on why Roma's going to be better, is that I think he's had as much bad luck as it comes. Do you kind of agree with that assessment? What do you make of Tammy so far? Are you excited of him being the long-term striker for Roma?
Yeah, no question. I think there's been a lot of bad luck for him. You know, he's hit 7 posts already in all competitions, which is a lot. I know Roma's hit a lot as a team. They've hit the most in Serie A, but he's already hit 7 individually between Serie A and the Conference League, which is 16 matches played. So, you know, he's only scored 5 goals in all competitions, 3 in Serie A. He's had a couple assists. He actually assisted Shomurodov's goal also on Sunday. So to see him get a goal and an assist was encouraging. He also hit a post in the match, so it just kind of continued that trend of bad luck. But, you know, looking at his career numbers, he's usually pretty spot on with his XG versus his actual goal scoring. You know, a couple years ago for Chelsea, he was expected to score 14 goals and scored 15. Last year, was expected to score 6 goals, for Chelsea and scored six. This year, his XG is a 6.3 and he scored three times. That just kind of speaks, I think, to the bad luck that he's had. And I think we'll see him continue to improve, but it goes beyond goal scoring so much for him because we see him work hard. He'll track back on defense when Roma needs him to. He can beat players off the dribble. He can hold up the play when Roma needs him to on the, you know, start a counterattack and do some of these things. So he has added a lot to the side. I am excited about him being kind of the long-term replacement for Dzeko. You know, Dzeko did a lot for Roma, so I don't like to trash him like some Roma fans do because he did mean a lot to the side. And he was getting up there, and I think it was time to move on. And I think if you had to move on, Tammy is a player you can certainly build an attack around. He has an exciting element and one that I think Roma fans are going to like to have around for a while as long as, you know, that activation of the repurchase clause isn't done by Chelsea in a couple seasons.
Yeah, look, I don't think Dzeko would have been nearly as good had he stayed at Roma. He probably needed some new motivations, and he did join a team that I think is just bad. I mean, I think it's objectively a better team. So I don't think he would have played quite this way, but I do think a lot of the things that he did were underrated at Roma. But now let's talk about another player that I'm pretty intrigued, and I thought VR last season was really a very intriguing player. When I look at Juve, I'm like, man, VR could play on this team, I think, quite a bit. So are you surprised that he has really not found any space? And do you think if he leaves, there's the potential that Roma's going to regret this one?
Yeah, so it's an interesting case study because last year under Fonseca, he made 21 starts, almost 1,900 minutes in the league and 33 appearances. And he looked like one of the bright upcoming young midfielders. You know, Roma found him in the Spanish second division with Elche and got him pretty cheap in that winter Mercato where they also got Ibanez and Carlos Perez. And he looked like he might emerge as like the star of that Mercato. And he was really, you know, a favorite of Fonseca's. And now this year under Mourinho, I did expect him to have a bit of a harder time finding playing time under Fonseca, rather Mourinho, because he's not a tough midfielder. He doesn't really stick a foot in very well. Off the ball, he's not the greatest. But it's, again, 23 years old, so you figure there'd be some room to work with him. But he has not made one appearance for Roma in the league yet this season, which is kind of crazy when you think about a guy who was playing so much last year, and he's a younger player, not like an old, washed-up guy. So very surprising. I wouldn't be surprised if he goes in January just because he's going to want to go somewhere to play. You know, he's been in the Spanish, like under 21 and under 23 mix and those kind of things. And I'm sure he's going to want to play, minutes somewhere so he can get into the national team mix moving forward. Mourinho even said after the conference league, that's the only place he's made any appearances for him this year. He has not played in Serie A. He's played, made a couple starts in the conference league. And after the last match, Mourinho said, you know, I like some of the things Gonzalo did on the ball on Thursday against Bodo last week, but off the ball, he still needs a lot of work. So, you know, he was one of those five players that was kind of jettisoned into the stands after the 6-1 debacle against Bodo. So it kind of speaks to what Mourinho thinks of his game, at least in terms of where it fits in his system. So in the long run, could Roma regret selling him probably below market value this January or in the coming summer? Possibly, but I don't think if Mourinho sticks around for the 3 years of his contract that VR will probably ever have like a strong role in that side. So I guess in the long term, it's probably better for him and Roma if he does move on, if Mourinho sticks around.
Yeah, and I see a few teams in Serie A that could use a player like that. So a VR is maybe the highest profile player of the ones that have been worked out with Mourinho. Anyone else you think should be maybe reintegrated? I have to say, when I heard him complain about Juan Jesus and Bruno Perez, I was like, well, you still technically have Fati and Santon, but I don't have a feeling you have much appetite for that being back in the squad. But is there anyone else that Mourinho has used very little or not at all that you think could help Roma turn things around?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say on Santon, I was a little surprised he was one of the guys in the summer that was completely, like, cut off from the squad because Mourinho brought him up with Inter. I thought there might be some appetite to have him as, a depth player, which is something Mourinho complained about this week. But I think those, you know, that bridge is long gone to reintegrate those kind of players. You know, Diawara, there doesn't seem to be much of an appetite there. You know, Reynolds, I feel kind of bad for because here's a young kid, came over from the States, got a little bit of his feet wet under Fonseca. And now, you know, every time Marino has a press conference and complains about depth, it's, I feel like Reynolds' name gets dragged through the mud a bit. So I think a loan for him probably hopefully does him wonders in the near future, because I think he could be a player for Roma in the future, but just not at the moment. So of the guys who were kind of, you know, sent away and thought to, you know, think over their mistakes after that Bodo match, I thought Kumbula was the most likely to be reintegrated, and he has been. He started against Venezia on Sunday and didn't look all that great. So to me, he's the most surprising one in terms of the type of player that he hasn't found much success under Mourinho yet, because Mourinho, you know, has a reputation of being a fairly defensive-minded coach, you know, and Roma's been the opposite this year. They've been very attack-minded, and, you know, Mourinho's tried to use those attacking weapons at his disposal to score goals, and at times it does leave the defense exposed. And I guess Kumbula surprises me the most, because I thought maybe Mourinho could mold him. You know, he was great under Juric, and now today there were some rumors emerging that Juric is interested in bringing him to Torino and kind of saving him from what he's going through right now. So if he sold off so quickly, a year and a half after Roma paid pretty good money for him in a part player exchange, part cash deal, with a not so much playing time, not much success, I think that could be one they regret in the long run, because he's still, I think, 22 years old or so. And he seemed to have such a high ceiling at Verona a couple of years ago.
Yeah, look, I'm a fan of Kumbula. I have to say, I used Torino on FIFA. I did bring him over because of the Juric connection. So, yeah, I can see it for sure. Okay, let's close on this. Actually, we have a few more questions, but more specific on Roma. Let's go with this. It can be good or bad. It can be one good, one bad. I'll let you decide. But which two Roma players surprised you the most this season?
So I'm going to start with Lorenzo Pellegrini, and I'm not surprised because I didn't think he was a good player. I've been a big fan of his since he came back from Sassuolo, but what surprised me is just how good he's been. Like, he's taken his game to another level this season, and now we go and find out he's basically been playing the last month with, like, knee inflammation, fighting through it, which is why he's going to miss the Italy matches this coming weekend. You know, he's taken the club and really taken the leadership role on. He's taken it in his performances as well. You know, the match winner against Cagliari was just a beautiful free kick goal, one of five goals that he scored already for Roma this season as a trequartista, not even like, you know, he's not a striker, he's a midfielder, and he's pouring in goals. He's also got a couple assists in the league. He's just been really good. I mean, this week against Venezia, he led the side with eight key passes. I think I saw a stat from, I think it was Who Scored, on one of those websites on Twitter, and that was the most key passes by any player in the league in a match this season. So he's just been very impressive. I'm so happy to see that from him, just because I've been a big fan of his, like I said, from the beginning. So to see him really blossom, it's really encouraging, because he's been a very polarizing figure. If you follow, you know, social media, he gets a lot of flack from supporters, and probably because he's a Roman, and every Roman that comes through is compared to the likes of Totti and De Rossi and these guys. And he may never hit that level, but I think he's at the point where he's starting to really hit star type levels, where he will be known outside of Rome and outside of Serie A bubbles, and he'll be more known around Europe. And I feel bad for him that he has to miss these matches for Italy, because with some of the other injuries in Italy's midfield, I think the Switzerland game could have been a good chance for him to shine on the international stage after he missed the Euros. But he would be my one surprise. I was going to go with VR as the negative, but we already talked about him, so I'll go with one more positive, and that would be Rui Patricio, because he's just a breath of fresh air in the goal. You know, once in a while he looks a little slow on a goal here or there, but nothing compared to what we saw from Robin Olsen and Paulo Lopez the past three seasons, where it was torturous to watch, you know, team shoot at Roma's goal. He made a couple great saves on free kicks at the end of that Venezia match. That match could have ended 4-5-2. And he's made some other saves in some other big matches to keep Roma in games. You know, some people point to some of the mistakes he makes, like on the Milinkovic-Savic goal against Lazio. He's a little slow coming out, and he got beaten on that one and headed home by FMS. But overall, I have to say I'm pleased with his performance. You know, maybe the bar was set low by the last couple keepers, but He's no Allison, you know, but he provides solidity. You know, he provides a sense of security back there for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, you can make a case. No team upgraded as much as a position as Roma did as keeper of the top ones in Serie A. I mean, maybe Napoli with Anguissa, but yeah, really huge upgrade. I agree with you there. Okay, so let's close this with a few predictions. So let's start with Roma. If you had to guess now, where do you think they're going to finish in the standings?
I'm still going to keep my optimism, and I'm going to go for fourth, just because I think Roma will continue to improve under Mourinho as the year goes on. And, you know, I think a lot of the teams around Roma still have their own flaws. You know, Atalanta, Juve, and Lazio have all had their own struggles. So I think I'm going to say fourth. I could easily see them finish sixth or seventh too, I think just because those teams are so tight. But at this point, I'll still keep some optimism despite the rough patch that we saw in October.
So it sounds that you are optimistic on Roma, but maybe not so optimistic to think that they can be in the Scudetto race. So I'm curious to get your objective opinion on this. I know you love following Calcio. You've seen some of these teams play Roma so far. If you had to guess now, with about a third of the season in, who's going to win the Scudetto?
It's a tough one, because I listen to your show, you know, weekly, and I know you still favor Inter. Part of me still favors Inter as well, just because they are the defending champions. And I do think Napoli and Milan will regress at some point. But with the 7-point gap after the Derby, I think, you know, for some reason, something's telling me it's going to be Milan, just because I think they will kind of follow the Inter path from last year and crash out of the Champions League as a fourth place team, not have to worry about Europa League. And not having those European matches we've seen, especially with Inter last year, just how much that can help a side that's making a push for a Scudetto run. I think Napoli, especially when the African Cup comes around and they lose players like Koulibaly and Anguissa, they'll take a little more of a step back. I have to go with Milan, I think, just because of that 7-point gap that exists between them and Inter right now. I think if Inter had won the Derby, I'd be a little more confident to go to the Nerazzurri, but I think right now the Rossoneri have a bit of an edge.
Look, you know, I left that Derby thinking that Inter showed me that they are a better team than Milan, and I know Milan fans hate when I say it, but that's how I feel. But at the same time, it also shows me that Milan really feel like a team of destiny. I mean, if you have your backup keeper save like a good penalty like that and everything else, they've just overcome so much that, I could see it. Okay, so
yeah,
let's
and I have to say,
this.
David, just to throw in real quick, I don't think Milan is the best team in the league either, and I've been saying this for a while with some of my buddies, and it just feels like they find ways to win matches that they sometimes shouldn't win. And that kind of gives you that team of destiny feel, like you were saying.
Absolutely. So let's close on this. Teller, I love the work that you do. Tell our listeners a little bit what's going on at Chiesa di Totti. I know it's international break, but even during the season, what can people expect on the site and the pod?
Yeah, so we just released our most recent podcast Tuesday, kind of looking at Mourinho and, you know, is he coming up with tired excuses, words of wisdom? Should Roma just mailed in the Conference League to focus on the league and those kind of things? So that's across the Romaverse podcast and all the major platforms on chiesaditotti.com. One of our writers and editor, Brent, actually put out a deep dive into Roma's shooting woes, because they've had tons of shots, but very few on goal in many of their matches lately. So he tried to decipher what exactly is going on there. I know one of our other writers, Jimmy, will be doing something on Reynolds' situation. I might look into doing a Karsdorp piece, because I know he's come under some fire this year, to see if he actually has regressed or not. And trying to just come up with some creative ideas to get us through the international break before, you know, our match day coverage kicks off again in a couple weekends.
Okay, it was great to hear Steve. Roma's always very entertaining. Before we get to Inter and movies with my dear friend Andrew Barker, we're going to do a special part of the podcast for our patrons. If you enjoy Calcioland, consider supporting us on Patreon. You'll get an extra episode every Tuesday. Next week, we'll actually have a Napoli outsider. We have him on once a month, where him and I go 90 minutes talking about cultural topics. Personally, I think that is worth the subscription alone, because he's really, really brilliant. We also have tiers with articles. I write one or two articles a week. We have Enrico Passarella, who's superb. We also have our friend Frank Risotto from Australia. His articles are available to all. It's a great community. We support an awesome charity. So we're trying to make a really positive community to follow calcio and help this great Insuperabili in Italy, which run football camps for kids with disabilities. So longtime listeners of the podcast should not be particularly surprised that the next guest is here during the international break. Andrew Barker is always one of our favorites. But during the international break, we try to, you know, maybe look a little bit beyond the football world. So we'll talk a little Inter with Andrew, a team that's near and dear with him. But we'll talk a little bit about the movie industry, some good movies to watch this time of year. For those of you not familiar with Andrew, he's the senior features writer at Variety, one of the best places to keep up with pop culture. And he is a great Inter fan based out of Los Angeles. So, my dear friend, always a pleasure to chat with you. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Yeah, thanks, David. I like the idea that you have me on during international breaks. Like, you know, nothing's happening. Like, you know, so, like, who can we go to? That's good. That's good. I like that.
There you go. Well, you own it, and it's always a pleasure. So let's start here with Inter, because I've covered Inter with a lot of guests, and with you, I like to take, if you will, a little more philosophical approach. So if you had to use one word to describe Inter this season, what would it be, and why?
One word, stable. I would say stable, right? Because, during the summer, you know, there were times when it felt like the sky was falling, you know, completely with all the financial issues and all of the player sales and the coaching departures and what have you. So I remember thinking at the time that I would be perfectly happy as much as I would like to see, obviously, Inter, you know, retain the Scudetto. Just now that, you know, Juve's sort of evil spell on the league had been broken, I would be happy to see a fun, competitive season where Inter does not embarrass themselves, you know, where Inter is competitive the whole way through and also at least advances in the Champions League, doesn't embarrass themselves in the Champions League, doesn't fall apart in some dramatic, you know, quintessentially Inter fashion. And they haven't, you know, they're in third place, likely, I would say, although I probably shouldn't even say that, to advance in the Champions League. They've never looked terrible. Sometimes they've looked pretty damn good. They could win the Scudetto. I don't know that they will. I think Milan and Napoli look better. But they're right up there, you know. So they're a stable team and seems to be no serious drama. Stable. Nice and stable. Slow and steady.
I like it. And for Inter, that is not usually a word we associate them with, that's for sure. But I like it. I think that is right. A good description. So obviously there were three big departures this summer, and I was pretty optimistic that Inter was going to be okay. But I have to say they exceeded my expectations a little bit. But obviously there were some painful and big name departures. They've been overall, I would say, replaced pretty well. But these were some really significant figures. So let me ask you this. Rank them in order of who you miss more right now between the former coach Conte, who is now at Spurs, Hakimi, who is balling over at PSG, and Lukaku, who went back to Chelsea. In what order do you miss them the most?
All right, I'll do like reverse order. So I would say Hakimi I miss the least, which is not in any sense like, you know, an insult to him because was awesome and is awesome. But I mean, just the fact that he was only there a year. He seemed to be the most obvious person that Inter was going to lose going into the transfer window. And I feel like while his goals and his speed and his contributions are like obviously missed, I feel like Inzaghi has managed to figure out a way around them. So I don't think about him all that much. In second place, I would say Conte himself. And once again, I mean, obviously you can tell he's not there anymore. It's a very different team. But I feel like the structure and the mentality that he put in place, enough of that has been retained. And, you know, while I don't think the team is as sharp or as kind of, you know, terrifyingly disciplined as it was under Conte, I don't think that they're different enough now for that departure to be as huge, although it is big. So yeah, I definitely miss Lukaku the most. Even though, I mean, he hasn't, you know, obviously he's been injured, so he hasn't quite torn it up, you know, at Chelsea as much as he did at Inter. But I still feel like there's an absence there, you know, as decently, I think, as he's been replaced, it's just not the same. You know, the Inter still scores goals, but they don't have that guy who you just assumed more often than not was going to score because he did. And the guy who, if there's really nothing happening in attack, you get it to him and he will hold it or he'll do something wild with it. Just that central, like, terrifying focal point that just every team has nightmares about going up against. I don't think Inter has that. So I think he's definitely the most significant absence, even still.
I like it because Zeko's been really, really excellent, but I don't know. It's kind of hard to project that he'll be able to do that over the time. And yeah, I agree. I think Lukaku just brought a sense of danger and fear in the opponent that I think this team maybe lacks a little bit. So I like that order. So let me ask you this. What did you enjoy watching more? Did you like more Conte's Inter, which was maybe more determined, impose their will, or this Inzaghi team, which feels a little bit more free-flowing offensively? What is more enjoyable to you to watch as an Inter fan?
Well, I mean, as an Inter fan, whoever wins is the most enjoyable coach to watch, right? I mean, so, you know, no matter how they get there, you know, if it's, you know, Helenio Herrera, you know, playing however he played, if they win, it's great. But if I were like a neutral who was not, you know, dangerously emotionally involved in the results of an Inter match, I would say Inzaghi's Inter is just more entertaining. Just because, I mean, like, as you said, there's a more free-flowing element to it. Like, it's more of a surprising team to watch, you know, like Conte. I mean, which is not to say that Conte's team was not exciting to watch, because they were, especially, like, you know, when they were on the break. I mean, that was amazing, you know, the way he had them play. But something about the kind of more creative, maybe less sort of a regimented way that Inzaghi plays, I feel like you're more likely to just see players coming from out of nowhere, and just sort of moves that you never would have seen coming. You know, like Conte's whole thing was half of the time you knew what he was going to do, but the team just did it so well that you couldn't defend against it. Whereas with Inzaghi, I feel like he's got a lot of sort of a, you know, cards up the sleeve and rabbits in the hat. And so, yeah, I mean, they're fun to watch, you know, but not so fun if due to that exuberance and sort of a left-brained approach that they give up goals, of course. But yeah, definitely kind of a flashier and sort of just more, you said it, just flowing kind of style.
So let's talk a little bit more about Zeko. I have to say, he's been really sensational. And I thought in the derby, a lot kind of changed when he was worn out in the second half. Who has surprised you more? How seamlessly he's replaced Lukaku, at least for now, or Darmian, who continues to be a really good player for Inter, and he's surpassed Dumfries, who was kind of supposed to be Hakimi's heir apparent, and many of us, including myself, were like, oh, great, Inter got Dumfries. This is probably as good as you could have done replacing Hakimi with Inter's budget, but Darmian's been really good. Who surprised you more, and do you think they can sustain this?
I mean, you kind of hinted at it. I mean, definitely Dzeko, I mean, surprised me the most. I mean, just in the sense that, I mean, I wasn't expecting anything, honestly, out of that guy, which is not any, you know, which is not an insult to him at all. I just figured that, I mean, the man's 35 years old, you know. He'd seem to be slowing down at Roma. That's what happens to players. You know, you can't expect them to keep it up forever. But he's, I mean, he's been considerably better than I would have expected. I mean, I almost thought of him as sort of just like a break in case of glass sort of striker, you know, better to have than not. And I mean, I was even surprised when Conte kept trying to bring him in, because I thought, really? I mean, sure, he's got another year or two left, you know. But then again, it sort of reminds me about how, you know, back in the day, Inter under Gasperini, actually. He really wanted to bring in Rodrigo Palacio. And myself and pretty much any other Inter fan I knew didn't understand why. It was like, really? Like, I don't know if it's that guy, you know, Inter quality. And then, of course, he comes years later and he's infinitely better than anyone really probably was expecting him to be at Inter. Still one of the more underrated Inter players of the last decade, I think. And I think Dzeko so far, and it's early days, has kind of impressed me in the same way. It's like, oh, okay, this is why Conte wanted him. I get it. He's still got a lot in the tank. So, I mean, yeah, just him for sure. Although I like you, I would be surprised if he could just keep it up through three competitions the whole season. I mean, he's 35 years old. But with Darmian, what surprised me about him is just the fact that, you know, Conte is kind of famous for having his eye on certain players who other managers of kind of top level teams might not be looking at. And so there's always kind of this idea that, you know, when Conte comes in, he's going to bring in some players who are going to work great for him, and then they're going to be on your books for an eternity, you know. And I think the funny thing is that Arturo Vidal and Darmian were both those players, you know, just like, okay, what are we going to do with Arturo Vidal once Conte inevitably leaves? But both of them, I think, are looking better under Inzaghi than they were before. So that's the thing that surprises me, because Darmian was very good last season, too. But just the fact that neither of them just sort of dropped off, you know, down to the bottom of the bench in Conte's absence, I think definitely surprised me.
Yeah, you know, I could see Dzeko kind of having a little Ibrahimovic 2.0 kind of phase. I have to say, you know, in the summer, I was like, Roma might miss him. And a lot of Roma fans were like, oh, you're basically telling us you're not watching Roma. And I was like, no, he's a good player. And look, Tammy Abraham's been good for Roma, I think. But you can't really say that they're better without him. So I think he's a really underrated player. I've always been a big fan. Let's talk about Brozovic, another player we've talked about on this podcast many times. I'm a huge fan of his on and off the pitch. I'm of the opinion that it's more important for Inter to keep Brozovic than even Juve, Dybala. There's a lot of Kessi with Milan for sure. I see Brozovic as such a key player on Inter. So tell me a little bit how you feel about Brozovic, and would you be pretty heartbroken if he were to leave?
I would be. I mean, I think, I mean, probably from, who would it be from on? But definitely from, you know, the Spalletti years on, Brozovic has been the linchpin, obviously, of Inter, of the midfield, just of the whole team. So I think losing him, you'd have to conceive of the entire team in a different way, right? I mean, because he has such specific sort of attributes that he brings. And they're so central to just every basic move that Inter does. It would require a whole rethink, I think, of the midfield, right? I don't know. There's something about just the vibe I get. I'm almost not totally optimistic that he stays, though. You know, you saw, like, because Inter, you know, they did a bunch of re-signings. You know, they re-signed Barella, they re-signed Bastoni, I think.
Lautaro,
and apparently they're already looking to get an extension for Di Marco, even though he just joined. So you really sense that Inter is trying to, you know, in concert with that whole stability thing I mentioned, you know, like, okay, this is going to be the young core of the team for a while. And so the fact that Brozovic, there hasn't seemed to have been much movement with his contract, it makes me wonder if he hasn't kind of made up his mind, which would be a bummer to see him leave, especially like without a transfer fee, obviously. But he's an enigmatic sort of guy, you know. Like, I don't think anyone really has figured Brozovic out. So I feel like if he's tired of something, I feel like he's just going to go for it. And so I would be bummed, and I think it would be a real. I think the effect on the team would be bigger than maybe a lot of people realize if Brozovic leaves in the summer. But yeah. I'm not super optimistic that he stays. That's just a vibe thing. Obviously, I don't know anything. But
Okay, I hope you're wrong. But I hear what you're saying. They have extended other guys. And yeah, and you're right. Obviously, it would bring a big change to move on from him. So, Andrew, we don't just bring you on during the international breaks. We usually bring you on when a big rock star or actor or someone in the pop culture world passes away. Luckily, none of this happened recently, but we do love talking movies with you. For me, it's always such a treat to speak to someone of your caliber about movies. So give me like a big picture view of how you see the movie industry right now. I've been going back to the movie theaters pretty regularly. I have to be honest, I wasn't sure I was going to do that because, you know, it is indoors. But I really like it. I've tried to do the streaming thing at home for a new movie. I just hate it. But how do you see things going? When I go, I have to say the movies are pretty packed. But there seems to be, you know, a lot of confusion on movies released in movie theaters, what's on streaming, contemporary. Sometimes it doesn't seem to me much rhyme or reason to me on how they're released. But you obviously know a lot more about this. So tell me, how do you think the movie industry is doing now that we are, I don't even know if we're in the post-COVID world, but in a world where we're living with the virus?
Right, right. I mean, I think you're spot on there, actually. I mean, it's like you kind of say with the whole confusion aspect, I mean, that is such a new thing, really, when you think about it, that, you know, a giant new blockbuster movie comes out and a lot of people, you know, just normal people who would, you know, used to go see new movies in the theater have no idea where it is or where they can find it or when. You know what I mean? It's like, because every release is different. Like, okay, is this a limited release that's also going to be on HBO Max in a week? Is this going to only be in the theater? Is this already on Disney Plus a week ago? I mean, it's all kind of a mess, and I don't know how soon, if ever, that whole mess is going to resolve itself. I do feel like there's a little more spring in the step, though, just because, I mean, not only have, you know, movies been open and fairly well attended recently, but, you know, you had these kind of symbolic releases finally happen. Like, you know, the James Bond movie, I think was the first giant blockbuster to move initially when the pandemic happened. And then it kept moving and moving and moving and moving. And so to have that finally come out, you know, to have Dune finally come out, which is supposed to be out last year, you know, West Side Story is coming out, you know, provided nothing crazy happens in December. You're getting through like that whole backlog of these, you know, giant movies that were waiting to be in the theater. And it feels a little more back to normal. But I don't know what the long term effects are of having people, you know, literally have no idea if a new movie comes out, if it's in the theater or not, or if they can see it at home. I don't know. It's going to be weird to see it shake out, but it definitely feels like there are enough reasons for people to feel more normal about it, if that makes any sense.
No, it does make a sense. So I want to talk to you a little bit more about Dune. And I know this one movie you saw on the big screen. I have HBO Max. I knew I wanted to see it on the theater. I'm not the biggest science fiction fan. The one that David Lynch did, that one was a little rough one. So I did try to watch a little bit at home. I couldn't get past the opening monologue explaining what was going on. But when I went to see it on IMAX, I was absolutely blown away. So just tell me a little bit if you were surprised by it. I'm assuming you liked this movie, how good it was and how well received it's been. I think it's done pretty well at the box office. I think they were happy enough to it that they added the part one to it on the title now. So you think this was pretty well received and that it surprised you in a positive way?
Oh yeah. I've actually seen it twice now. And yeah, no, I liked it a lot. It was, there was something, I think because, and it takes on like an extra, you know, significance, I think, because just the, you know, the whole future of film and the theatrical experience and what have you felt so tenuous for so long. And to have a movie that is so almost aggressively pitching itself as an epic, you know, as sort of like a sci-fi Lawrence of Arabia that, you know, has to be seen in the screen with this Hans Zimmer score, just like, you know, rattling you in your seat. It was refreshing to see. And I'm glad that it's done. Yeah, like you said, it did pretty well. But the part one, I think, was always there because I saw it in an early screening and the part one was always there. But the idea of making a part two, that was totally up in the air, as far as I understand. I mean, they really might have stopped it right there. This was kind of a real trial by fire, honestly, you know, because clearly they spent a bajillion dollars on this and all of it's up on the screen. And so hanging over this movie is sort of the question, not just will they make a second one, you know, to complete Dune, but are they going to make movies this big anymore? I mean, is this sort of like the twilight of the giant blockbuster, you know, spare no expense kind of filmmaking? So to see it do well enough that they're going to make part two, I think, is a very good sign. And obviously just it would be incredibly disappointing if they left it just one half of a movie. My wife actually didn't know that this was just part one, and she didn't know that they hadn't even started making the second one yet. And she was like scandalized. She's like, what do you mean they haven't shot it yet? Like, they haven't shot it yet. They might not. It's like, what's wrong with these people? So I think that's a real positive sign. And I love the movie. So.
Yeah. How do you like it compared to some of Villeneuve's had some awesome movies? How do you kind of see it among his work? Do you have it towards the top? I mean, he's had some really good ones. It feels like he hasn't missed so far.
I'm hot and cold on him, to be honest. I'll be totally frank with you. I don't know that I finished his Blade Runner. I know I watched it. I know I started it. Arrival kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I go back and forth with him, actually. This is my favorite one that he's done. I felt like it felt, I mean, it sounds weird to say complete because it's literally an incomplete movie, but it felt the most completely realized to me. And I feel like his, critics, I think, other, you know, critics in general, I think, are often hot and cold on him because there's something very humorless about him sometimes. And I don't know, that aspect of his style didn't really bother me this time. Like something like Arrival, it felt like it needed more of a human touch than he's capable of providing. But I thought this was just like a sort of perfect canvas for a filmmaker like him.
Yeah, I was really, really impressed. So I have one more sci-fi question, and this comes from our great patron and supporter, Majin, who loves asking you questions. So his question is, between LucasArts with Star Wars, not including The Mandalorian, and Warner Brothers with DC property, which one mismanaged their IP the most, and which has the better upside to turn the things around moving forward?
That's a tough question, actually. I mean, because they both mismanaged them in different ways when you think about it. You know, like I feel like the DC stumbles have been so much more chaotic and kind of obvious that one would be inclined to look there. And Star Wars, I think that they both made very different types of mistakes. Like I feel like DC clearly wanted to have, I mean, this isn't a secret, obviously, like this is, they're broadcasting this. They wanted to have something equivalent to the MCU, right? And they were doing that with like a very specific kind of vision, you know, which was mostly Zack Snyder. And then either the movies, depending on your point of view, either the movies didn't work or, you know, Warner Brothers kind of got a little cold feet about it and started hedging their bets. And it just introduced this whole element of chaos where no one was really sure what to expect, what to see. And just batting really inconsistently. You know, I mean, they have, you know, that the first Wonder Woman movie, I think just about everyone liked, and then the sequel, literally no one liked, you know, and then you know, they had that Harley Quinn movie kind of come and go, and then everything that went, you know, upside down on Justice League. So those are really obvious. I feel like with what Star Wars did, they almost seemed to do the opposite, as opposed to overthinking it and making sure there was this giant overarching vision that they then got cold feet on. They almost just seemed to assume that, like, hey, we've got Star Wars. We'll just keep pumping these movies out. People will go see them. It's Star Wars, you know, and I feel like not only did they kind of they botched the ending of that trilogy, and they overestimated just how successful constant Star Wars movies would be. So I don't know. I mean, it's weird to pick which one. I think both of them, though, are probably seeing a decent way forward. You know, with DC going back to, you know, the most consistent character that DC has, which is Batman, and they're making a Batman, and they're giving it to, you know, Matt Reeves, who's a fantastic director of blockbusters, to let him do what he wants with. I mean, who knows how the movie's going to turn out with, but that makes sense, you know, as opposed to, okay, we got to bring Aquaman into Justice League Part 7, and then we got to map all this out. You know, just like, no, just Batman movie, there, boom. Yeah, everyone likes Batman. Whereas Star Wars, I mean, I think what's interesting about Star Wars, you know, you said not including The Mandalorian.
But, he didn't make it easy on
But, I mean, when you think about how sort of Star Wars fandom has sort of survived over the years, and some of the things that have helped it the most are these kind of ancillary things, you know, like, I mean, there are so many Star Wars novels that really kind of kept the world and the franchise alive, you know, before they decided to do the second trilogy, which, and that's kind of what The Mandalorian is, right? It's taking, as opposed to just these giant space operas, it's taking a small story set in that world and exploring it. You know, it's kind of like what a novel would have done. And then I know, I mean, I always say that, I mean, I'm not unique in this, I don't think, that the best Star Wars story, aside from the first trilogy, was the video game, the...
Rogue One? No.
No, the... oh, Jesus. I played it a million times when I was a kid. Why can't I remember it? Knights of the Old Republic. Brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant video game. And that was kind of like during the second trilogy, which people were a little lukewarm on, and you had this video game. So once again, it's kind of, and they're remaking that, you know, they're kind of going back to that well. So they are kind of like, I feel, digging a little more into like the deep nerd kind of aspects of Star Wars, which I think is what has kept it as big as it is for so long. You know, even if, you know, the general population was not reading Star Wars novels, it kept it in the pop culture conversation. So what am I trying to say here? Still, I say DC has a better chance of turning things around, because you just make another Batman movie, you know, or make a good Wonder Woman movie, you know, just take it a piece at a time, you know, because I mean, I think what, you know, what Marvel did and the success that they've had over the last decade and a half is pretty unprecedented. And I don't know if it's repeatable. And honestly, I'm not sure if Marvel can keep this up. You know, they almost feel like, you know, they're the Roman Empire right now, you know, and they've defeated the Carthaginians and the Parthians and the Gauls and everything. And now they have to figure out, all right, what do we do now? You know, like, and you can kind of see the pieces coming apart from within. You know, they can't get the Black Panther sequel up and running for a number of reasons. You got Scarlett Johansson suing them. You know, you kind of got all these things kind of starting to come loose around the edges. So maybe don't try to do exactly what they did, because that might be a once in a generation kind of thing.
Awesome. So let's close on this, and always wonderful to have you on, Andrew. So give us first three movies from this year that you would recommend to our audience. So I added that caveat, you know, not huge cinephiles, like a good movie that you think someone during this international break needs a little break from. What three movies from this year would you recommend to them?
All right. Well, yeah, I'll just keep it really simple. First, Dune. Go see Dune. It's great. We talked about that before. I would definitely, definitely recommend Parallel Mothers, which is Pedro Almodovar's new film.
Nice.
Great. I mean, it's just, you know, he kind of has like two different modes of movies that he makes sometimes. He kind of has the really serious ones that, you know, get nominated for Oscars. And then he has like the really sort of far out, campy, you know, very kind of queer, very kind of silly movies that he kind of makes on the side. And I feel like this is kind of somewhere in between the two, which is kind of the way I like him the most. I would definitely recommend that one. And actually the movie that has surprised me the most that I've seen this year, that I was not expecting to like at all, is King Richard, actually.
No, which, I want to see that. That's the Will Smith, Serena Williams movie, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see that. Yeah. So tell us, that's good? Because the trailer was a little
That I was just going to say that. The reason I didn't want to see it was I saw the trailer, and I thought, I've seen this movie 500 times before. This looks so on the nose. This is just your classic, you know, just sort of like you know, inspirational true life sports movie, whatever. And it is like very, it does very much fit into that kind of, you know, Hoosiers, Remember the Titans kind of, you know, uplifting sports movie. But it's so much more interesting than that trailer makes it look. That trailer really underserves the movie. It's more complex. It kind of hits sort of more ambiguous notes, I feel, than the trailer really lets on. And of course, it still gets you with a giant rousing climax because we all know what happens to these girls, right? But I was surprised at how well done it was and just how engaged I was with it. So definitely.
Like, I love it.
If you're a sucker for that kind of like Remember the Titans kind of movie, it really hits that spot with a few extra little, you know, interesting little grace notes, I thought.
Will Smith's going to get Oscar buzz for this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's definitely getting nominated for it, for sure. And probably awesome. Anjanae Ellis, too. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they will be. It's quite good.
Can I get away with it on HBO Max, or I should go to the theater to see this, right?
I mean, go to the theater if you feel the moral obligation to support, you know, the theatrical experience.
Yeah,
of course. It's a perfect TV movie. Yeah, you don't need the whole giant screen for this. You know what Will Smith looks like, you know, so.
Yeah, I hear that. Okay, so let's close on this. So King Richard's, for me, I haven't seen it yet, so that's one of the ones that I want to see now. Any other movies that are coming out later this year that you're excited to see?
Well, definitely, I mean, this is the most obvious response ever, but Licorice Pizza. I mean, it's all Thomas Anderson. You know, anything that guy does is worth watching. So, and I've heard good things so far.
Awesome. Well, Andrew, I can't thank you enough. It's always wonderful to talk to you. You know, I always say this, but if you're looking to improve your writing, check out what Andrew has on Variety. Really outstanding stuff. We always love hearing your thoughts on Katsa. So I promise next time I won't bring you on during an international break, and it won't be after someone passes away. So thank you so much, my friend.
But that's my niece, man. Yeah.
It is. But we'll get you out of your comfort zone. But thanks so much for doing this, my friend. It's always a real pleasure.
Sure thing, David.